Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello everyone. This is Peter Paul Verzola, and this is Election Day in America. I don't know where my guest is. We're having this problem. I don't know what to do. At any rate, we're prepared somewhat. This is Election Day in America. It's also the day here, roughly the first week of November, that we elect presidents. And then yesterday was the birthday. Well, today is the birthday of Michael Dukakis, who ran against Ronald Reagan, and he was defeated. Former governor of Massachusetts, first American of Greek ethnicity to run for president. It's also the birthday of Shirley Chisholm, congresswoman from New York City, first black woman to run for president. And yesterday, was two birthdays. James K. Polk, who decided one term was enough, and we acquired under his administration California, Texas, New Mexico, I think parts of Arizona, and Nevada on the Mexican War. So he should be remembered for that, and when he felt that one term was enough. So also yesterday, the 2nd of November, was the birthday of Warren G. Harding. Harding was, in fact, pretty well established now that he, and the various historians who have looked at his life, that he was the first president with black or Negro blood. And it's in several books. And his, and I've said this many times on this program as well as others, that when he was confronted with this accusation, scurrilous as it, the way it was thrown in his face, he said, "I can't help it if one of my ancestors jumped over the back fence." And of course, a lot of people who have black or African blood in their ethnicity, same thing probably happened. It's interesting to note, a lot of people thought that Valerie Jarrett was white, but the fact is both of her parents were black, but one of her, it was either her great-grandfather or grandfather on her, I think her father's side, who was a white Englishman. So and the same thing I think happened with Condoleezza Rice, former Secretary of State. I think she said that she had an Italian grandfather, her great-grandfather in her lineage. So it doesn't matter where you come from or who's in your background, but who you are and what you are and what you can do, what you will do, and what you're willing to do. That's the important thing to remember. It's the same thing whether you go to college or don't, whether you have a degree, a law degree, a doctor's degree, engineering degree. It's what you do with that education, what you do for your community, for your country, for your family, and for those of you who are into helping try to save the world, whether you do it by becoming a priest or minister or apostle of God, or you're a medical missionary or someone who's just going in the Peace Corps or whatever. But the important thing is what you are and what you make of yourself. Also, well, let's not forget Marie Antoinette. It's her birthday on November 2nd. So that's important for those of you who think that, the phrase, "let them eat cake," which is attributed to her. The woman was, she was a victim of her age and of geopolitics, that she married a guy. She was the daughter of Maria Theresa, the last woman empress of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and she was betrothed to marry this, Louis this, the 16th, who had a genital problem, and she had to have an operation. He had a difficult time trying to consummate that marriage, and she was just a young girl, way in over her head. And of course, she had some extravagant habits, like a lot of teenage girls do today. But she was confronted with the fact that the French peasants were starving, when she was told they have no bread, well, she thought, well, let them eat cake. They have cake. But, you know, whether you attribute that to stupidity or just a insensitivity or naivete, the fact is, I think she was unfairly targeted. And, of course, she spent a long time in the Bastille, and they finally beheaded her, much to the glee of people like Robespierre and the other of that tribunal, who, incidentally, all of those guys died violently, or died. One of them died on the guillotine himself. Danton was one of the first to go. This famous movie you should catch, Danton, is one with, I forgot his name. His face is in my mind, but anyway, that's one movie. And then the History Channel had an excellent series on the French Revolution, which had quite an effect on the American, my caller is coming in, and I'm going to bring him in right now. Hello, hello.
Hello, Peter.
Patrick, I was wondering what happened to you. I thought you were waylaid.
Oh, I was abducted by a band of aliens.
Aliens? Well, there's never any fiction that comes out of Chicago.
And, they look just like the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, and they insisted on...
Oh, well, I know your view on that. Oh, I just want to digress on this. I understand that the Chicago Cubs was bought by the Ricketts family. Is that the same family that owned the restaurant on Clark
no,
Street?
No, no, no. The restaurant of blessed memory was...
Hear me well?
Pardon?
Can you hear me well?
Can I hear you well?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, good, good. I can hear you well. I want a speakerphone at this point. I got a slight cold. Go ahead.
The restaurant of blessed memory was owned by an entirely different Ricketts family.
Okay. Of course, we used to joke about it, didn't we?
It was a bad name for a restaurant, really.
I know.
It's a little
and
bit
they
like,
didn't serve alcohol, remember that?
I know, but it was a little bit like naming a place Yours, you know, or, naming a place after malaria. it just was a bad name.
Well, I don't know anybody who ever got Tomaine there. I mean, we used to eat it quite a few. Mr. Adams, I think, was one of them. And
yes. Yeah.
Of course, your favorite was that hillbilly restaurant under the Wilson Street Elevated.
Was it a restaurant or a bar?
It was more like a lunch counter, or, you know, those cheap lunch counters of the 30s and 40s.
Okay, I think I was more interested in the dessert than the main course.
It's a lot walking that street. Oh, well, to be serious, there are people walking the street who are without jobs. Since this is election day, and I just mentioned we elect presidents, and, of course, one of my favorite was Warren G. Harding because he was so fascinating. But, Patrick, our president, or Mr. O, as he's called by his enemies and critics, tried to get the Olympics for the great city of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that nearly half of the people... A poll did not want the Olympics for various reasons. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, this is true. A number of people felt that Chicago, like a lot of host cities for the Olympics, was going to be left holding the bag, and that Louis XIV, or pardon me, Mayor Richard Daley, was the only one that really and his contractor friends were the only ones that were really going to benefit from this. Neighborhoods were going to be dislocated. Prices were going to go skyrocketing. It is true that some jobs would have been created. However, it's fairly safe to say that a lot of those jobs would have gone to the favored few. The average Chicagoan would not have had a chance to see in person the Olympic Games because, of course, the ticket prices are much, much too high. It was a testament to Daley's massive ego. And in recent weeks, he's gotten taken down a few notches. He's forced, for example, to have the city have the smallest Christmas tree since 1955. The big city Christmas tree down at Daley Plaza. Mm. is the smallest it's been since 1955.
Well, isn't that when his father got the narrowest election of his life? He was Robert Merriam.
Right. Yeah. And so we've got this really small tree that we're going to be having around Christmas time. And as you know,
it's going to be a real tree.
Well, yeah, it's going to be a real tree. But as you know, in Chicago, as in San Francisco, size does mean something. And
I will not go further with that line. We have a sophisticated audience out there.
I hope so. I hope this is not.
You're going to learn very soon.
Being aired in the middle of the Bible Belt or whatever, but they're cutting back on lots of stuff. They're talking about cutting back on some of the big fests, such as Venetian Nights.
Oh, right, right.
They're
yeah.
talking about eliminating that. They're talking about eliminating a lot of your ethnic fests. I have not heard any reports about Celtic fests being on the hit list. But,
you have the IRA at City Hall.
Yeah, well, you know, the IRA doesn't have too much to do lately because, you know, peace has been declared. So a lot of the lads could come to Chicago. As a matter of fact, I once put up, never mind, I'm not going to, I don't know who's
right.
listening.
Oh, since you went along, let's just go along that line for a minute. Is it true that there are about 1 million Irish ethnics from the old country that have come into the United States illegally?
The last figure I saw was more like 400,000.
Okay. Well, that's the biggest ethnic group. I mean,
they're the biggest ethnic group, and Ireland is having tremendous bad economic times right now.
Right.
But if 1 million Irish people came over here illegally, believe me, you'd notice it because there wouldn't be too many people left in the old country. I mean,
that's
really.
Right. And now they've got birth control.
And I can remember a time, in fact, not too many years ago when the Celtic tiger was running rampant. When they were encouraging Irish and Irish Americans to return to Ireland, that there were all kinds
right.
of jobs, and there was this, for the first time in 1,000 years, reverse migration. That's ended now.
Yeah, there was an excellent program on PBS, Out of Ireland, in more ways than one.
Yeah.
Oh,
In fact, now I'm sure there are signs on many businesses in Ireland, no Americans need apply.
Yes, I'm talking about history coming full circle. Patrick, now we hear that the Daley, the second administration, is privatizing a number of municipal services. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, they're talking about privatizing a lot of the snow removal. They're talking about privatizing a lot of the street cleaning. They have sold the parking meter concession.
How much does it cost to park a car there?
To tell you the truth, I don't know. Since
I know you don't have a driver's license.
Yeah. Since I use the CTA, I have no idea, but I keep hearing that it's absolutely outrageous. I mean, you could end up spending $30 parking a car in the loop, not even for the whole day.
What about parking tickets? Are they exorbitant? Because they are here.
I'm told that they are. Yeah.
And they tow your car. They tow in Chicago
They do tow in Chicago, and they tow in Chicago if you've got, I think it's more than 3 outstanding parking tickets.
Oh, it's 5 here. Of course, if by the time you get your car, do people get their car back intact after they pay the toll?
Well, what do you
know
mean
how
by,
that works?
What do you mean by intact?
When people die and the coroner gets his hands on the corpse,
right.
I've heard that they've even sawed off fingers to get at the gold rings. Wasn't that Mike Royko that
said
that?
Yeah, that's been known to happen. You know. Yeah, it has, and as far as intact is concerned, if you're concerned about having the tires on your car and stuff like that, then you know, yeah, it has happened where items have been removed from cars.
CD players and all of that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Got, Well, yeah, that does happen in other cities as well, not to pick on Chicago. Well, you know, this is very interesting, Patrick, since you're in the media. Did you know, in fact, most people do not know, that San Francisco is one of the few cities that give a parking exemption to media people? And what these people, I call them news writers, they park their cars by meters and sit on their fat fannies in City Hall and sit around and swill Starbucks and a few snorted Coke. I caught them in the press room. But I understand Chicago does not grant press passes for a parking exemption for media. Is that true?
You do have a press pass which will enable you to park in certain places if you are covering a breaking story.
Ah, okay.
If you're just covering a story, involving the Thursday afternoon meeting of the Lakeview Ladies Garden Club, why then, no, you're not covered. If, on the other hand, you're covering a breaking story like a hostage situation or what have you, you do have limited coverage, but you do have to display your press credentials right on the car and all of that sort of thing.
Oh, well, this is an anecdotal story. Do you have parking meter maids or men get into fisticuffs with each other?
No.
With people who dispute a parking ticket?
No.
Oh, it's happened here. In fact, we had a big lesbian deck a guy and put him in the hospital. They were both parking meter people. And
yeah.
I wrote a column called Don't Mess with Dee Dee. I'll just post that one up on my...
So what are you saying? The parking meter people fight among themselves?
There have been disputes. We had the disreputable Art Agnos administration back in 1989 when you had the earthquake. He brought in two lesbians from Boston, and they didn't even change their driver's license or their plates. And there was all kinds of lesbian incest and sex parties after hours at the parking headquarters. A lot of scandals. And of course, I imagine you have a more upfront lesbians in the public purview.
Well, I'm sure we have lesbians in public life. They don't necessarily flaunt it, but they don't hide it either. I mean, it's one of these things that, you find lesbians in every walk of life, including even the clergy.
Yeah.
And, it's one of these things that they're there. We know it. And I guess a lot of us just don't give it a second thought. As far as any kind of a lesbian conspiracy to run the city or anything, there's no more a lesbian conspiracy than there is a gay conspiracy or an Albigensian conspiracy.
Bring back the Inquisition. Do it right this time, I jokingly.
Hey, what a wonderful day for an auto da fe.
Well, hey, by the way, there is a lot of people don't know that Portugal had one of the longest-running Inquisitions and one of the worst. I'll talk to you later.
This was before they had cable TV.
I think with the Obama administration being under a lot of pressure, especially from the homo activists out here, to overturn Don't Ask, Don't Tell, to drop the blarring of at the immigration borders of allowing HIV-positive people into the country and other people with communicable diseases. It seems like they're moving inch by inch with an agenda, and there is a concern. And, of course, you and I both remember Illinois was the first state to legalize homosexual relations between consenting adults.
Right.
It wasn't the Stonewall scam that 1969 in New York City. That's what I call one of the political fictions that needs to be corrected.
Yeah, well, this whole issue has left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths.
No pun intended. Patrick, what's the state of the media in your neck of the woods?
Sheer panic. I mean, Well, here's the thing. You got the Chicago Tribune in bankruptcy. You've got the Reader in bankruptcy. You had the Sun-Times in bankruptcy. We no longer are. We have a new owner. You have some major problems. And incidentally, as you well know, with your legal background, bankruptcy does not necessarily mean that you're going out of business tomorrow. It means you're looking for protection which will enable you to continue functioning so that you won't have to go out of business.
What's happening with the real estate in your neck of the woods? Are people, a lot of foreclosures, pre-foreclosures?
There are still a lot of foreclosures. On the other hand, the real estate market is at least in high-priced places and some middle-level places, but not all, in some neighborhoods. It's undergoing a bit of an uptick.
Now, I talked to an official in the county board. I had to do a research project on some property, and she told me that Chicago has become the condo cap, downtown Chicago, with all the office buildings. Is that true?
This is true. This is true. And as a matter of fact, that's not a bad transformation, because you had a lot of buildings which were vacant and really not suitable for modern offices. And,
oh, yeah, I remember some. I worked in several.
Sure, like Printer's Row, for example.
Right.
Both all used
place
to
I
be
worked.
Printing plants.
Right.
And,
well, I understand that's real chic.
Yeah, yeah. Now they've turned them into, you know, some very, very nice condos. And you remember Bill Smith, the guy who ran as the beatnik candidate for president.
Oh, vaguely.
Well, Bill Smith and the early 70s sat down with me, and he outlined a plan for completely revitalizing the Loop. And it called for taking all these factories and warehouses and what have you and turning them into residential housing. And at the time, I mean, I thought it was a cool idea, because I figured if I worked in the Loop, this would be great. But a lot of people thought he was crazy. But wouldn't you know it, this is exactly what has happened. Your residential housing in the Loop is such that you've got whole new precincts there. The politicians are having a ball registering everybody. For people who work in the Loop, it's absolutely great to be able to walk to the office. And the Loop, as you know, was getting pretty dark for a while there. I mean, after 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, it was a ghost town for a while. No longer the case.
What about, now that you're talking here in San Francisco, some of the downtown streets have been blocked off to automobile traffic. They have to turn off just before they enter the major financial district. Has that happened in Chicago?
No. As you know, for a time they turned State Street in Chicago into a mall.
Is it still a mall?
It's not a mall anymore. They got
what happened?
They just decided it wasn't working as well as they had hoped. So they let the cars back on there. But here in Chicago, that hasn't been done, because Daley isn't yet aware of the fact that a lot of people do not drive and would like to see this more of a walking town. It's coming, and the reason it's coming is because, let's face it, owning a car, being able to park a car where you've got permit parking in most neighborhoods in the city now, it becomes increasingly expensive, and even if you got oodles of money, it's a major hassle. So it's going to drive a lot of people. CTA ridership is way up.
Oh, what does it cost to ride the bus or the trolley?
It's $2. Well, we don't have trolleys anymore. It's $2 to ride the L, and it's $1.75 to ride a bus.
Oh, now what about transfers? Are they time
transfers? I believe, because I have a pass, so that
how much is that?
I get a monthly pass.
I mean, how much is the pay? Because here it's like $70, I think.
Yeah, here well, because of the fact that I qualify as a senior citizen, I get well. In fact, I don't pay anything now because seniors ride free.
But oh, they don't. Now that's something you got on us.
Before that time, it cost $75.
Oh, well, that's pretty. Yeah, we were hollering here. It was $30. Yeah, seniors pay 60 cents unless you get a permanent pass, and that's
yeah. Yeah.
Got a few minutes left, Patrick. Is Senator Burris going to be a critical vote if Senator Reid gets through his health care plan?
I, to tell you the truth,
what's that, Pat?
I don't know because Senator Burris has been a kind of a mysterious cipher on a lot of things, where you just don't know where that guy is coming from.
When is up for re-election, if he runs?
If he runs, which is questionable, I believe it is 2 years from now. He's finishing out a term, remember.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he could decide to retire with all the graft he may have acquired. Or
he will probably do so because he's not having a lot of luck lining up contributions for his campaign war chest.
Yeah. By the way, whatever happened to that black woman that was a city official, then ran for the U.S. Senate, became a senator, and then became ambassador to New Zealand?
Right, Carol Moseley Brown.
Yeah, where's she at?
She's still around. She lives in a condo in Hyde Park.
Okay.
And
next to Bill Ayers.
Yeah, probably in the same building. She's still around. You don't hear too much about her. So she's probably enjoying her.
Got a lot of pensions there,
well,
you know.
Well, she's got at least two pensions that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
She'd have a state pension because of her service as a state official, and then she, of course, has got a federal pension. And
what's going to happen with Blago?
What is going to happen with Blago? Well,
you got a minute to go yet, Pat.
Yeah, I think that. I think he's going to do time.
Well, I think he's going to roll over on some people.
Oh, he is, but I think what they
if he
really,
hasn't already.
I think what they really want is him.
Oh, okay.
I think he's going to end up doing some time.
Well, he better be in a safe place, or otherwise he'll need knee pads and chapstick.
Well, you know, he may be a tight end, but he'll come out as a wide receiver.
Yeah. Well, Pat, we're calling you Chicago's new Mike Royko. Is that fair?
I think it does. I think it does an injustice to the memory of Mike Royko.
We'll come up with something.
You'll come up with something. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll keep you emails, and thanks for being on the program, Pat. And
my
we'll,
pleasure.
And really? By the way, I'll just tell people that I keep these programs up. They're free to access them on, at the archives at any time. I don't take them down. So
sounds
they can listen
good.
At any hour, they have a computer.
Sounds
gotta
very
become
good. Okay, we will talk soon.
Yes, thank you for being on.
My pleasure. Bye.
And for you folks, go to our YouTube, Amicus Veritas. We have Mel Belli and not the night of his iguana, but the death of his iguana at part one. And go to Verzola.com and roll over to AmicusVeritas.org. If you want to email us, it's pverzola@gmail.com. And I want to thank our guests for being on, Pat Butler, who I've known for many years, recently became a grandfather. And his family has a lot of history, Spanish-American War. We'll get into that in another time. And we would encourage any suggestions, questions, or comments. I can't compete with them. So, again, thank you for tuning in, and tell other people about the program. This is Peter Paul Verzola. Thanks for listening. Okay, Deb, I'm off the air. Had a great interview.
Attack me, according to the New York Times. And Americans for Prosperity. I like them. I'm an American. I'm for prosperity. I've discovered from 40 years of reporting that what creates prosperity is limited government. And
that's what these people espouse, right?
And I would like to share that with as many people who
right,
want
so,
me to speak.
So they hire you. You fly down, I guess, to Arkansas, right?
Right.
With your Texan smile. All right, we've been waiting, we're still waiting on the results from that congressional race that we've been talking about in upstate New York. That's, of course, the one where Sarah Palin, where the Tea Party crap.
While Radovan Karadzic demanding more time to prepare his defense, the prosecution insisting he should not be allowed to dictate the timetable. Karadzic said the prosecution was chaotic. It had sent him more than 1 million pages of evidence in the 5 months since May alone.
No decision by any chamber can change the fact that I have had only 5 months. With all due respect, it is 5 months only. I have been snowed under with all this material. The prosecution was not trial ready.
The prosecution urged the court to get tough and either to compel him to attend in handcuffs if necessary or to appoint a defense counsel to attend on his behalf. Yesterday, in his absence, they accused him of the murder of more than 7,000 Muslim men and boys at Srebrenica in July 1995. They said they had radio intercepts that revealed one of his most trusted commanders, Radislav Krstic, ordering the murders as part of a pre-planned operation. Are you working down there? Krstic asks a subordinate. Yes, of course we are working, he replies. Kill them all, Krstic says. Don't leave a single one alive. The court also watched videotape of Serb forces ordering a captured Muslim man to call on his own teenage son to surrender.
Your Honors, that man being forced to call to his son was a man named Ramo Osmanovic. His remains were found in a mass grave. His teenage son, Nerman, to whom Ramo was forced to call with the promise, quote, it's safe to come to the Serbs, unquote, his remains were found in a mass grave as well.
Radovan Karadzic says he won't be ready to listen to any of this for 8 months. The judges said they decide what to do about that by the end of the week.
So the court at last has had a taste of the kind of evidence that Radovan Karadzic will one day have to face here. When that day will be is still far from clear, because Karadzic has again succeeded in pushing it further into the future. And in Bosnia, this enduring sense of justice not yet done means that all these years on, the war remains unfinished business. Alan Little, BBC News, The Hague.
Afghanistan's president has welcomed his new term in office by promising to banish the corruption he says has taken his country and government. Hamid Karzai also proffered what he called an olive branch to his Taliban brothers. There was no direct mention of his rival, Abdullah Abdullah. whose withdrawal gave him victory by default. From Kabul, the BBC's Andrew North.
Afghan president once more. But there was no victory celebration for Hamid Karzai. Just relief the whole troubled election was over and a promise of reform.
To make sure that the taxpayers' money, excuse me, coming to us from your countries is spent wisely and rightly by us, the Afghan government, and also by the donors themselves.
He vowed to remove the stigma of corruption from his government. There was an olive branch, too, for the Taliban, urging them to take part in peace talks. But they've called President Karzai a puppet. A program to reintegrate the Taliban is getting underway, with cash incentives. It's being led by the former head of the SAS.
The money would not go to the individual. We did not see ourselves taking money, and because that's paying money for bad behavior. I'm not really too keen on that. You know, these may be upset brothers, yeah, they're damn upset, and they'll be killing a lot of my good friends. This is about turning around and taking them away from the violent road they're in, and so therefore it's about money that goes into the community, into the environment, that which we set ourselves to do in 2001, which is the object of a counterinsurgency is to give a better life. So let's start doing it.
But for this to work, the Afghan government also has to do much better at looking after its citizens.
I think our president needs to make his mind and bring some fundamental changes in his cabinet and his entire system because lots of Afghan in the international community is complaining about the corruption in Afghanistan. So this is very important that he should focus on this.
After such a flawed election, President Karzai is now under huge pressure to show he can run a cleaner and more effective administration, with the West struggling to justify continuing to spend so much blood and fresh air here. And without a credible Afghan government, there's little chance of turning back the Taliban insurgency. Andrew North, BBC News, Kabul.
More of the main stories for you. General Motors has cancelled plans to sell its European car business Opel. GM had agreed to sell Opel and Vauxhall to the Canadian car parts firm Magna. But in a statement, the US giant says its board has made the decision because of what it calls an improving business environment for GM over the past few months. One of the most important thinkers of the 20th century, the French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, has died. He was 100. A leading exponent of structuralism, his work included new theories about how primitive and modern societies share common patterns of behavior and thought. The Italian government is to appeal against a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights that bans crucifixes from classrooms. The court ruled the crosses are a violation of parents' rights and children's freedom of religious choice. Many politicians have reacted angrily. The Vatican is studying the ruling. Events today have paved the way for a new look Europe. The EU will have its own president and there will be fewer collective decisions which individual countries can veto. The last obstacle to the Lisbon Treaty becoming European law has been removed, with the signature at last of the Czech president. BBC's James Roberts reports on, like it or not, an historic day for Europe.
You might have thought this controversial treaty was a done deal almost 2 years ago, when all 27 member countries came to Lisbon to sign up to what they'd agreed after years of haggling and argument. But there was one clue then to the trouble ahead. Gordon Brown missed the signing. Britain, always in a class of its own within Europe, looked less than enthusiastic. In fact, it's been others who've held up the implementation of the treaty and kept its very survival in doubt.
Rozhodnutí ústavního soudu jsem očekával.
Today, the President of the Czech Republic, Václav Klaus, finally agreed to sign ratification by his country, the last to do so. Last month, the people of Ireland reversed their rejection of the Lisbon Treaty. In a second referendum, they said yes. So 7 years of debate about reforming the European Union are now ending. The treaty will be in force from the 1st of December. The Lisbon Treaty is intended to streamline decision-making. It creates a new post of President of the European Council to increase Europe's influence in the world. Some national vetoes will be lost, and critics fear more power will move to Brussels. However, the treaty also gives members of the European Parliament, MEPs, more power to scrutinize legislation. Today, as it became clear the treaty was secure, Gordon Brown gave his judgment.
I hope that Europe can set aside years of constitutional and institutional debate, years of having to deal with institutional issues, and that we can move forward and deal with the main issues that the European Union must now face, and that is how to create jobs, how to build growth, how to tackle climate change, how to build greater security for the peoples of Europe.
It's 20 years this month since the Berlin Wall came down, ending the division of Europe east and west. That was the seismic political event which produced first a much expanded European Union, and then the years of argument about a new treaty for that union, a treaty which is now in place. James Robbins, BBC News.
Five foreigners convicted and jailed for a plot to overthrow the government of Equatorial Guinea have been pardoned and released. They include the man said to be the ringleader, former British Army officer Simon Mann. Several prominent figures were said to have been implicated, including Mark Thatcher, son of the former British Prime Minister. He has always denied involvement. BBC security correspondent Frank Gardner has this.
Sentenced, in effect, to die in a West African jail. This was Simon Mann at his trial last year in Equatorial Guinea. The British mercenary was given a 34-year sentence for plotting to overthrow its government. For the Eton-educated Guards officer and son of an England cricket captain, his world has come crashing down. But tonight, he's in shock, pardoned and on his way home. He was only told he'd be freed last Thursday. With over a billion barrels of oil reserves and wide disparities of wealth, Equatorial Guinea may have been a tempting target for a coup. So what was the plan, and what went wrong for Simon Mann? March 2004, arrest the made in Zimbabwe as a plane full of mercenaries lands to pick up arms. August that year, Sir Mark Thatcher is arrested at dawn in South Africa. September 2004, and Simon Mann is sentenced to 7 years jail in Zimbabwe. January 2008, Mann is extradited under protest to Equatorial Guinea to face coup plot charges. In July, he's sentenced to 34 years in the notorious Black Beach prison. And then, today, Mann is pardoned and set to fly home to Britain. So why the sudden pardon? Well, South Africa's President Zuma is visiting shortly. Equatorial Guinea would like to clean up its international reputation. But above all, Mann has cooperated fully with the authorities there.
The government there used him to get as much information as they could. They got him to name other names to accuse people, such as Sir Mark Thatcher, of their involvement in the plot. And having done all that, the last thing they now wanted was for him to become some sort of cause celeb.
Sir Mark Thatcher is the highest profile figure to be implicated in the coup. He's pleaded guilty to unwittingly bankrolling it. Simon Mann may now have more to say.
It's going to be interesting when Simon Mann gets back to the United Kingdom if he's going to give us some extra information, because the trial processes that he's been through have been very irregular. The human rights organisations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have heavily criticised it.
There's no question that Simon Mann has been through hell. Without a pardon, he would not have survived his sentence. But now he's coming home, we may at last learn the full story of Africa's mercenary whose last adventure nearly ended his life. Frank Gardner, BBC News.
Good to have you with us on BBC World News. Don't go away. Still to come. Why some Muslims in Azerbaijan believe new terror laws are simply an attempt to stop them worshipping. First, though, doctors are being urged to take another look at the treatment of millions of patients who take aspirin to prevent heart disease. Researchers say the risks and benefits of a daily dose for people who haven't already experienced heart problems are very finely balanced. This is from BBC Health correspondent Jane Hughes.
Rory McCallum knows that he's reached the age where he has a slightly increased risk of having a heart attack or stroke. He works hard to keep fit and healthy and to eat well, but like millions of us, he's also been taking a daily aspirin to protect himself. So he finds the latest advice somewhat frustrating.
I am confused now, you know. You tend to hope that what they say is true. So now I'll probably just go back to what I do know is okay, or much better for the heart is go to a gym, do exercise 3 or 4 days a week.
There's clear evidence that aspirin is beneficial for people who've had a heart attack or stroke. But for those who haven't had symptoms, the risk may be as great as the benefit. Today's paper calls for a change in GP's guidelines.
For people who haven't had a heart attack or haven't had a stroke, the evidence now suggests that there's a very fine balance as to whether they'll get any net benefit for them. So will it reduce the chances of having a stroke or heart attack? Possibly. But on the other hand, it might well give them a serious side effect, like a bleed. And so it might actually, in the long run, do them net harm rather than good.
For millions of people who currently take a daily aspirin to prevent the possibility of a heart attack or stroke, this advice means a change in habit. But the best medicine for preventing problems remains staying active, eating well, and anyone who's concerned should go and see their GP. Jane Hughes, BBC News.
Just to remind you, get many more details on that and all the international news anytime you want it on our website. That's bbcnews.com. The latest headlines for you this hour on BBC World News. Accused of genocide and war crimes, the former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic has finally appeared in court. It may be the last time for a long time. And Afghanistan's President Karzai has pledged a government for all Afghans and issued what he called an olive branch to his Taliban brothers. In a very early test of President Barack Obama's political pull, 2 US states are choosing whether to stay blue, Democrat, that is, while voters elsewhere are electing a handful of congressmen and big city mayors. For more on that, over to our special correspondent, Philippa Thomas, in Washington.
Well, Mike, the two big races to watch tonight are in Virginia and New Jersey, where voters are choosing their governors. For a closer look at those and a handful of other face-offs around the country, I'm joined here in our studio by David Mark, senior editor at Politico.com. Of course, the Republicans, especially David, are saying this is a referendum on Barack Obama's popularity, and presumably that's because the Republicans are feeling quite optimistic.
Well, that's right. The Republicans are really trying to point to specific areas of the country where Barack Obama did very well in 2008 and say, we are going to win here. There's a couple of governorships up. There's a prominent congressional race. These are all areas where Barack Obama did very well. If Republicans take the vote there, they can say, hey, this is a repudiation of the president's policy.
And it's partly because of economic choice comes into play, doesn't it? But unemployment's still up, and voters still worry about when the economy's going to bounce back.
Right. We have this interesting dynamic. President Obama personally has always been more popular than his policies. He's very well-liked domestically, just like he is abroad. But when you start drilling into his actual economic policies, health care proposals, he's not quite as popular, less than 50% or so. And that's really
what kind of Republican Party is it? Because we do see a lot of this rhetoric that small government, anti-tax, but the Republicans themselves are somewhat split.
That's right. We have this continuing rift between the more conservative elements of the Republican Party and the more moderate folks, and they're kind of going at each other. There's one congressional race in upstate New York where we're really seeing that big split, and it's kind of a question about the future of the party, and that's probably the Democrats' best hope on election day, that the Republicans kind of blow themselves up and go in different directions.
One more vote that's really interesting, David, and says something, I think, about American society. In the state of Maine, they're having a referendum on same-sex marriage where the state Congress, the politicians, pushed this through in May. Now all voters get a chance to say what they think.
Right. This is a real cultural touchstone in America. This is rather important, actually, because the big argument you hear against gay marriage from those who do not support it is we don't want legislators. We don't want politicians pushing it through. People through initiative should do it. Here we have the chance. We'll get a sense of what the people actually think about the issue of gay marriage.
Well, I'll keep watching that, David. Thank you for joining us here in the studio.
Thank you.
Mike, we'll have those results, reaction, and White House reaction for you tomorrow.
Philippa there, and David Mark of Politico. A woman known as the Godmother, who headed a mafia-style gang in southern China, has been sentenced to 18 years in jail. Xi Kaifeng was found guilty of running underground casinos and bribing government officials in the city of Chongqing. Her trial was part of a crackdown in a city of 30 million people over the past few months. Claims in court that she kept 16 young lovers helped to fuel public interest in the trial. Muslim clerics in the energy-rich state of Azerbaijan are complaining that the government is shutting down mosques and limiting their activities. The authorities argue they're trying to uproot terrorism. The BBC's Tom Esselman has it.
The Daddy of Azov calls his fellow worshippers to prayer in the back garden of his house in western Azerbaijan. His mosque has been closed down. The authorities say it's because they need to restore it. But he thinks it's because the government is targeting him with a new law on religion, which was rewritten this year. Fearing the spread of radical Islam, it has banned any Muslim who's received his religious education abroad from leading religious practice. Let me explain my view, he says. Everyone should be free to follow their own religion. They closed our mosque and it's made us angry, he says. Why did they do it? It shouldn't matter that I've spent time abroad. But I think by closing the mosque, they have violated the law of Allah. Azerbaijan is a country with vast oil wealth. And because of this, the government is worried about attacks by foreign extremists, which target the country's resources. They say they thwarted a planned attack in 2007 by Islamists targeting embassies and some of the country's oil plants. They see this new law as a vital step. Unfortunately, those who study abroad want to bring the laws of their state into Azerbaijan and to politicize religion. But Azerbaijan has its own tradition of Islam. We don't want to be another violent republic like Chechnya, Ingushetia, or Dagestan. These students in the capital, Baku, are being taught the Quran, according to a curriculum cleared by a government-approved Muslim board.
The government hopes that by teaching students in classes like this one, that it can foster a sort of homegrown Islam. Under the new law, people can only leave religious ceremonies if they've received their education in Azerbaijan. That's led critics to say that this is all part of an attempt to stifle freedom of expression.
In 2008, this mosque in the capital Baku was shut following a grenade attack, apparently planned with the help of foreigners. The government closed it, fearing fundamentalism could also exist within the mosque. But its members deny being radicalized and say the attack was an outside job. People like Vidadi say the government's efforts to keep the country secure come at the expense of his religious freedom. He says he's not broken the law, and with no sign of his mosque reopening, his home remains his daily place of worship. Tom Esselman, BBC News, in Azerbaijan.
People in the Venezuelan capital are having to get used to dry taps as they begin what may be 6 months of water rationing. Large parts of Caracas will be without water for up to 48 hours, as the BBC's Will Grant reports.
Caracas is a dry city. A two-day water rationing program has started across the Venezuelan capital, expected to be the first of many in the coming months as the country's water crisis begins to bite. The Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez recently called on his countrymen to spend just 3 minutes in the shower to save water and electricity. He blames the climatic effect El Niño for the city's empty reservoirs.
There can be few better illustrations of Venezuela's water problems than this, La Pereza Reservoir. Hydrologists tell me that at this time of year, the end of the rainy season, it really should be about half full. But as it is, this is supposed to supply a large part of Caracas.
Government meteorologists agree that Mr. Chavez is right. El Niño has caused a particularly dry rainy season, they say, which has hit Venezuela hard.
El Niño has caused, as a consequence for us in Venezuela, a fall of precipitation. And that drop in rainfall this year, which is about to end, has caused a huge reduction in the amount of available drinking water, as well as affected the provision of hydroelectric power in the south of the country.
The opposition, however, are not convinced by the government's arguments. They say a lack of investment in infrastructure rather than the weather has caused the current drought.
The problem with the public services is that you can't import them. Boats can't import water and electricity. You have to have public organizations capable of expanding and providing for a growing population.
In the shanty town of Mariche, many people don't care what the causes are. They just know they don't have a regular supply of clean drinking water. They are dependent on tanker deliveries from the opposition-run local government, which come every 2 weeks. Anything they need on top of that, they have to buy at inflated prices.
This tanker is the only supply of clean drinking water that these people can expect to receive this month. For the past 10 years, the government of President Hugo Chavez has prided itself on supplying basic goods and services at low cost to the poorest in Venezuela. However, when it comes to potable water, something is clearly going seriously wrong.
We use very little water. We bathe with small quantities. We recycle the water we wash up with for the lavatory. We bathe using water from washing clothes. It's not fair.
While the government has promised to prioritize the problem of water supply, their critics accuse them of simply waiting for a solution to fall from the sky. Will Grant, BBC News, Caracas.
Just finally couldn't resist this, I'm afraid. Russia, world famous for its vodka, a precious commodity. So imagine how this driver felt. The man steering the forklift reversed just that bit too quickly, and he hit a stack of vodka bottles in a Moscow warehouse. Just watch that domino effect. Within seconds, all the shelves came crashing down, in total destroying $170,000 worth of alcohol. Thanks for being with us on BBC World News.
Funding was made possible by the Freeman Foundation of New York, Stowe, Vermont, and Honolulu, Newman's Own Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and Union Bank.
I'm Julia Stiles.
I'm Kevin Bacon.
I'm Kim Cattrall.
Hi, I'm Ken Burns.
I'm Lily Taylor.
I'm Henry Louis Gates Jr., and public broadcasting is my source for news about the world.
For intelligent conversation.
For election coverage you can count on.
For conversations beyond the soundbite.
For commitment to journalism.
For deciding who to vote for.
I'm Kerry Washington, and public broadcasting is my source for intelligent connections to my community.
BBC World News was presented by KCET, Los Angeles.
Love Masterpiece Theater? Can't get enough of Antiques Roadshow? Never miss a night of the News Hour with Jim Lehrer? Donate your car and help pay for the programs you love to watch on KQED. Call 1-866-573-3123 or log on to kqed.org/cars to schedule a pickup that's convenient for you. While you're there, learn more about the tax deductibility of your donation. That's 1-866-573-3123 or kqed.org/cars.
You're watching community-supported public television, KQED.
Every bone came out of the ground. Something brand new to science. It was really amazing.
How did they become us? At last, science closes in on the answer.
We see the launching of the career that led to Homo sapiens.
Astounding discoveries tell a new story of the birth of humanity. Our story. Becoming Human, a Nova special. Our earliest ancestors, tonight at 8. Here's what's coming up tonight on KQED. KQED thanks our members and community partners for their support.
I'm John Yema, editor of the Christian Science Monitor, and this is the Map Area. It lets you see the world from the inside out. This is what the Monitor does. Our new weekly magazine and our website take you inside the world. They connect the dots. Online all the time and in print every week, the Christian Science Monitor gives you context, hope, understanding. We help you connect the global dots. We take you inside your world.
President promises reform. Margaret Warner is in Kabul. Gwynaifa looks at how the U.S. should deal with President Karzai. Then, after the other news of the day, Judy Woodruff has the latest on the Madoff scandal as the financier's auditor pleads guilty. Kwame Holman reports on the partisan split in the Senate over climate change.
Democrats on the Environment Committee pushed for cuts in greenhouse gas emissions, but Republicans boycotted today's session.
John Delenko tracks the stimulus money in a New York State school district.
This year, Rochester's share was about $30 million. Here and in most other districts, the bulk of the money was stored jobs.
And Jeffrey Brown has an auto industry update. As General Motors posts strong sales numbers, Ford announces big profits.
Major funding for the News Hour with Jim Lehrer is provided by...
What if made Grand Thornton a truly global accounting organization with access to resources in more than 100 countries? Is it their global capabilities, or is it their passion for how they serve their clients? Grand Thornton.
This is the engine that connects abundant grain from the American heartland to Aaron's best-selling whole wheat, while keeping 60 billion pounds of carbon out of the atmosphere every year. BNSF, the engine that connects us.
Monsanto, producing more, conserving more, improving farmers' lives. That's sustainable agriculture. More at producemoreconservemore.com.
Chevron, this is the power of human energy. Intel, supporting coverage of innovation and the economy. And by Toyota.
The William and Flora Schuler Foundation, working to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world.
And with the ongoing support of these institutions and foundations. And this program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
The president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, addressed his country today, and he called for unity. He also made a broad-based promise of reforms, but gave no specifics. Margaret Warner is in Kabul with our lead story report.
All those who want to work with me are most welcome, regardless of whether they opposed me in the election or whether they supported me in the election.
The Afghan president made his bid for broader support a day after he was declared the victor in a much-disputed election. But Hamid Karzai did not mention his challenger, Abdullah Abdullah, who dropped out of a planned runoff, charging it could be neither free nor fair.
On the government of the future, as I've stated earlier, it will be a government of unity. It will be a government for all the Afghan people. And as a matter of fact, as I've stated many times before, I don't have an opposition. I don't have any personality or any group as my opposition, and I don't want to be opposed to anybody. That's why I don't have a political party. So my government will be for all Afghans.
Karzai also extended his hand to the Taliban insurgents, urging them to come back to their country. But the Taliban claimed a victory of their own, crowing about their role in derailing the runoff. Our brave Mujahideen were able to disrupt the entire process, the Taliban statement said. Even the airstrikes and ground forces were not able to stop our Mujahideen from their attacks. Karzai conceded his government had been, quote, seriously discredited by administrative corruption. He promised to remove this stigma, to restore the confidence of Afghans and of the nation supplying tens of thousands of troops and billions of dollars to shore up his country.
We'll keep trying our best to address the questions that we have facing Afghanistan and to make sure that the wishes of Afghan people come true, and also at the same time to make sure that the taxpayers' money coming to us from your countries is spent wisely and rightly.
For his part, Abdullah stayed out of public view today. Instead, he huddled with his advisors on how to respond to Karzai and to the Afghan Election Commission that yesterday had declared Karzai the winner. Aides said Abdullah would lay out his plans and expectations at a midday news conference tomorrow. World leaders also watched and waited. On Monday, President Obama said the U.S. needs to see deeds, not just words, from Karzai. And today, Kai Ida, head of the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, said Karzai must weed out corrupt officials and name a competent government or risk losing international backing.
We are really at a turning point. We've seen how the support for the commitment to Afghanistan is being questioned in a number of troop-contributing countries and donor countries. That doubt has to be removed. It is first of all up to the president and his new cabinet to do that.
So what you're saying is if he doesn't make these changes, that international support could fade substantially.
I think the debate that we've seen over the last few months in the international community will become even more heated, even more difficult, if we do not have an important positive signal given through the composition of a new government.
Ida warned that Karzai should not delude himself into thinking international support is limitless.
Some Afghans believe that Afghanistan is of such strategic importance that we will stay here whatever happens. It is simply not correct.
In Washington, the big question mark has been whether to send more American troops to Afghanistan. President Obama continued to mull that issue today as he met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
We appreciate the sacrifices of German soldiers in Afghanistan and our common work there to bring peace and stability to Afghanistan and to create the environment in which the Afghan people themselves can provide for their own security.
Later, the Chancellor addressed Afghanistan and Germany's troop commitment there in a speech to a joint session of Congress.
The international community's mission in Afghanistan is without any doubt a tough one. It demands a lot from all of us, and it now needs to be transferred to the next phase as soon as the new Afghan government is in office. Our objective must be a strategy for transfer of responsibility.
France also said it would stay the course in Afghanistan. But British Prime Minister Gordon Brown echoed warnings that President Karzai must take immediate action on corruption if he expects the UK's support to continue.
And now Gwen Ifill examines the American response to the Karzai victory.
President Obama said he would not decide whether to send more troops to Afghanistan until the election was over. Now that it is, will a Karzai presidency make that task easier or more difficult? For that, we turn to Congressman James McGovern, a Massachusetts Democrat, who's called for the U.S. to ramp down its military presence in Afghanistan. And James Dobbins, career diplomat, who was the top U.S. official at the international conference that installed Karzai as president in 2002. He thinks the U.S. military presence should be increased. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Congressman McGovern, what is your initial reaction to the reinstatement, I guess we can call it, of President Karzai?
Well, President Karzai won by default. This whole election process was deeply flawed. We're told by Peter Galbraith that at least 30% of Karzai's vote was fraudulent. This is the guy that we're going to rally behind. I mean, do we really think that there can be a happy ending with this man who has been there now for almost 8 years? And corruption is not something new. This corruption has been a problem for all the time he's been there. And in the New York Times, Dispatch just came out. He was asked dealing with corruption might involve changing important ministers and officials, because as you know, that some of the people he's appointed are of questionable character. His response was, these problems cannot be solved by changing high-ranking officials. We'll review the laws and see what problems there are in the laws. I don't believe he's serious about changing the character of his government, And I, quite frankly, am very, very concerned about the future of our policy.
Gene Sovins, who not only Mr. McGovern, but also at least 50 of his colleagues agree with him in the House that this is something the U.S. should be pulling itself out of. What do you think in the wake of the election results?
Well, I think that the pressure on President Karzai to make reforms and to take a more vigorous role in limiting corruption is entirely appropriate. And I think that it's quite usual for the Congress to play a bad cop role and the administration to play a good cop role, the administration sort of providing positive reinforcement and the Congress branding the stick. So I think from a standpoint of getting Karzai's attention and getting action, this is up to a degree useful. I think the election was certainly a setback in terms of the manner in which it was conducted. But even after allowing for the fact that, even after disallowing the votes that were found to be fraudulent, Karzai got 48% of the vote in the first round in a field of 25 candidates. There's not a single member of Congress or American president who would get 48% of the vote if he was running against 25 other opponents.
So he's as legitimate, in your opinion, as you can be in the Senate.
You know, Afghanistan isn't surrounded by Italy, France, Germany, and Austria. It's surrounded by Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Iran. How many of those have legitimate governments? They don't even have elections. He was in an election which there were 25 candidates. There was some fraud. The fraud was met and dealt with by an internationally mandated commission, and he still got a very substantial vote, and he would have almost certainly won on the second round if Abdullah hadn't pulled out.
Congressman, that you heard President Karzai say today that his goal is to remove the stigma and at the same time to reach out to the Taliban, that he has no real opposition party against him. Do you think he's capable of doing that?
Look, I don't know, but let me just say that after 8 years, that's how long this war has been going on, billions and billions of U.S. dollars, we have lost, countless civilians, and we've lost, thousands of American lives. Yeah, this is the best that we can get, a president of a country who is now being installed by default. By all accounts, the election was not only a setback, but it was a joke. And, is this where we're going to put all our money? Are men and women going to die for this? This is a country, Gwen, that is not accustomed to a centralized government. This is the government that, quite frankly, is the government that the U.S. pushed for. And it's corrupt and it's incompetent. And I think we have to think twice before pouring more money into this system. And I certainly do not believe that by expanding our military footprint that we're going to accomplish anything. By all accounts, by establishing the foreign military footprint in Afghanistan, we are actually helping the Taliban get recruits. I think we need to move in a very different direction. Our original mission was to go after al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda has now moved to Pakistan. We're told by General Jones that there are less than 100 members of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Do we need 100,000-plus American troops to go after less than 100,000 members of al-Qaeda? We need to rethink this policy and reevaluate what we're doing.
Mr. Dobbins, with the outcome of this election, even if, say, for instance, it had gone, run its natural course, and for some reason Abdullah had won, would it have changed what the president's decision-making should be about what to do as far as troops go?
Well, I think that the irregularities in the election definitely make the president's decision more difficult. And assuming he makes a decision to give General McChrystal some or all of what he asked for, it will make that decision more controversial. I don't know that logically it should change the nature of that decision. After all, we didn't invade Afghanistan for the benefit of the Afghans. We invaded Afghanistan for the benefit of the Americans because of the attack on 9/11. And we've not stayed there for the benefit of the Afghans. We stayed there for the benefit of Americans because we don't want future attacks to be launched from Afghanistan or from neighboring societies, all of whom would be radicalized if Afghanistan plunges back into widespread civil war.
The congressman says the focus should be on Pakistan, not Afghanistan, if that's the call.
I think that Pakistan deserves a greater focus than we've given it. I think it was neglected for many years. And I think it's appropriate that a good deal more assistance and a good deal more effort be put into Pakistan. But I don't think that means ignoring Afghanistan. The border is porous. The terrorists will go back and forth wherever they're under least pressure. The last thing we want to do is succeed in Afghanistan and just have them all come back and take over, rather succeed in Pakistan just to have
Are you indeed, as Mr. Donner suggested, the bad cop here, you and others who have criticized Hamid Karzai, including the envoys of the region and even the vice president?
Look, I don't know if I'm the bad cop. What I'm trying to do is call it as I see it. And what I see here is the United States getting sucked into a situation, into a war, that has no end. You know, I've repeatedly called for an exit strategy with regard to our military. You know, I believe if you're going to go to war, you should have a clearly defined mission. I don't think we have a clearly defined mission in Afghanistan. A clearly defined mission is a beginning, a middle, a transition period, and an end. You know, I've asked repeatedly, at what point does our military contribution to the political solution in Afghanistan come to an end and we can bring our troops home? I'm not looking for a date certain, but I'd like someone to tell me how this all has a happy ending. I mean, look, our mission in Afghanistan is very different than it was when Congress authorized the use of force against Al-Qaeda after 2001. We have not, this mission is very, very different. We should have a thorough debate on this. I think the policy should be reevaluated in its entirety, and I think it would be a huge mistake to expand our military footprint there. I think it would be, and especially in the aftermath of this election. I don't want our Americans dying for a government that is corrupt and incompetent and that stuffs ballot boxes.
Is the mission different, Mr. Donner?
I think the mission has always been, from the moment that the Taliban was toppled, to try to leave behind a government capable of controlling its territory and denying it to extremists who would plot against the United States and other countries of importance to us. That has been the mission from the beginning. The mission was grossly under-resourced over the early years, and it's only been in the last year or two that we've devoted the kind of attention to this mission that it justifies, given its importance.
Well, we'll be devoting more attention to it as time goes on. James Dobbins, Congressman Jim McGovern, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Pleasure. In other news today, this was an off-year election day across the U.S., with races for governor in two key states. In Virginia, Republican candidate for Governor Bob McDonnell held a double-digit lead going into the day over Democrat Cree Deeds. In New Jersey, incumbent Democratic Governor John Corzine was neck and neck in the final polls with Republican Chris Christie. A vacant congressional seat in New York State was also up for grabs. The Republican candidate quit the race over the weekend after a conservative revolt. And voters in Maine considered repealing a law allowing gay marriage. The prospects of Congress finishing work on health care reform appeared to dim today. Senate Majority Leader Reid addressed the issue after meeting with Democrats behind closed doors.
First of all, we're not going to be bound by any timelines. We need to do the best job we can for the American people. We want quality legislation, and we're going to do that. We're going to do this legislation as expeditiously as we can, but we're going to do it as fairly as we can also.
On the House side, Republican leaders floated a bill that included caps on jury awards and medical malpractice lawsuits, among other things. It would not require that employers provide insurance. In economic news, billionaire investor Warren Buffett announced his company will buy the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad for $34 billion. He called it a wager on the economic future of the United States. For the record, the BNSF is an underwriter of the NewsHour. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 17 points to close below 97.72. The NASDAQ rose 8 points to close at 20.57. Buses, subways, and trolleys were shut down in Philadelphia today by a strike. Members of the transit system's largest union walked out last night after the World Series game between the Phillies and the New York Yankees. By morning rush hour, thousands of commuters had to find another way to go to work. The strike involved salary, pension, and health care disputes. The former Bosnian Serb leader, Radovan Karadzic, made his first appearance today at his war crimes trial in the Netherlands. He's accused of genocide and crimes against humanity in the Bosnian Civil War during the early 1990s. Karadzic told the tribunal today he will no longer boycott the proceedings, but he again demanded more time to prepare his case.
The situation is such that I would really be a criminal if I were to accept these conditions. to enter a trial and proceedings for which I am not prepared. I cannot challenge anything that the prosecution is going to put forward with so much material unless I am given more time.
The prosecutor rejected that argument. She urged the court to make sure there's no interference with the progress of the trial.
Mr. Karadzic cannot be permitted to manipulate the proceedings through his decision to not attend hearings. If necessary, force can be used to secure his presence in the courtroom.
The presiding judge then canceled tomorrow's hearing and vowed to decide how to proceed later this week. The prosecution alleges the former Bosnian Serb leader was behind the deadly siege of Sarajevo and a 1995 massacre of 8,000 Muslims. The Frenchman, considered to be the father of modern anthropology, has died. Claude Levi Strauss reshaped his field over six decades of work. He focused on finding common patterns of thought and behavior in a wide range of human societies. Claude Levi Strauss was 100 years old. Now, what's behind some good news for Detroit's automakers? Jeffrey Brown has that story. Not long ago, bankruptcy and potential catastrophe. Today, at least, some signs of recovery. GM posted its first monthly gain in auto sales since the recession began, up nearly 5% from a year ago. Ford reported gains, too, one day after it announced an unexpected third-quarter profit of $1 billion. We take a look now at Paul Ingracia, an automotive writer. His latest book, Crash Course, about the bailouts and bankruptcies in Detroit, will be published in January. And Louis Lataife, dean of the Boston University School of Management and a former top executive at Ford. He currently sits on the board of the Canadian auto parts maker Magna, which has sought to buy the European company Opel, a division of General Motors. Late today, we should report, the Associated Press said that GM has decided not to sell. Paul Ingracia, I'll start with you, and I want to start with Ford. It's the monthly sales gains, but also this surprise about profits. So how significant is this, and what accounts for the good performance?
You know, well, it's very significant, Jeff. I think that it's not only profits, but also, more importantly, frankly, it's positive cash flow. In the year-ago third quarter, Ford had a negative cash burn of $7.7 billion, which was frightening. This year, in the third quarter, the positive cash flow was $1.3 billion. And just the week before, Consumer Reports gave Ford quality ratings across its entire model lineup comparable to those of Honda and Toyota, which have long been the industry quality leaders. So there's lots of good news coming there. There's also some reality jolts, if you will. The company's bond rating was raised, but it's still deep into junk bond territory. But it's a steady improvement in quality and steady management, and frankly, having avoided bankruptcy is paying dividends.
Well, Mr. Lataife, just to fill in the picture a little bit more, as I understand it, Ford's revenues were actually down. So the profits are really coming from cutting costs, I guess, from the plants and layoffs. Is that it, or is it more car sales? How do you explain it?
Well, I think the car sales do contribute, but the finance part of Ford Motor Company has always been an essential part of their business model. And the financing arm did do well in this quarter. I think, as Paul suggested, there's lots to be encouraged about. The products are more acceptable. The company has done a good job of restructuring. It is not overstating their profits, because I did mention that they don't expect to be fully profitable on an annual basis until probably a year and a half from now. But this is certainly encouraging in the face of all that's happened in Detroit in the last couple of years.
And staying with you, when you do look at the auto sales, the gains that we just saw, how much can you tell about how much it is because of the economy or something that the manufacturer itself has done, or whether, of course, the big question, will it sustain itself? What do you look at to know?
I think the economy is coming back slowly, quite slowly. The sales rate of vehicles before the crash was at about 16.5 million vehicles a year. It crashed down to about 9, and that was pretty frightening for all of us. No one could have anticipated that kind of a fall off in demand. No business plan could ever have anticipated that. Well, before the cash for clunkers program was running in the 9s, the mid-9 range annualized, and then cash for clunkers did a nice job of pushing us up to about 12 million. It's now settled back down to about 10, 10.5, which is encouraging. That suggests that more buyers are finally coming back into the market. But 10.5 is not a very exciting sales rate in an absolute sense. You'd like to see it at 12, 13, 14 eventually, and so the economy still has a way to go. But I do think the economy is starting to bubble back up and consumers are beginning to spend again.
Well, Paul and Gracia now spread that, filled in the picture a little bit more, the economy to GM and Chrysler. Both of them out of bankruptcy, both moving forward supposedly with comeback plans. GM had some good news this month, Chrysler not. So what's going on there?
Well, I think this reflects what's happened at each company in the last few years. You know, Chrysler spent an absolutely disastrous decade of ownership under first the Germans, Daimler-Benz, and then under a New York private equity firm, Cerberus. And basically during this time, very little new product got developed, and the product pipeline at Chrysler is virtually dry. General Motors had sort of the opposite problem in a way. It rather stubbornly insisted on clinging to 8 brands, and the government, as part of the bankruptcy worked out last year, earlier this year, whittled that down to 4 brands that will continue. I mean, there's still 8 for now, but the 4 are being phased out or sold. But in those core 4 brands, Chevy, Cadillac, GMC, and there's one more, in those 4 brands, Buick, excuse me, in those 4 brands, there are some pretty good products in there, and so I think it's GM just had more of the core product strength than Chrysler going into this crisis.
And Paul, when you then look at all 3, the big 3 here, when you see Ford doing well, is Ford doing well at the expense of the others? Is it possible that to the extent that there is a recovery underway, we're going to see it affect companies in different ways?
Well, absolutely we will. In fact, we're already seeing that. And yes, Ford is doing well at the expense of the other companies in part. You know, it was actually quite interesting when the President's Automotive Task Force early this year debated how to approach dealing with and perhaps saving the U.S., hopefully saving the U.S. auto industry. They were sharply divided over whether it was worth the effort in terms of taxpayer dollars to save Chrysler. The task force was quite evenly split on this, and President Obama himself cast the deciding vote. And one of the reasons that the task force was evenly divided on Chrysler was that some members maintained that GM and Ford would have a better time of prospering, a better chance of prospering, if Chrysler was to go out of business, and the whole Fiat ownership and control of Chrysler was sort of a long shot to save the company anyway. We'll see.
Now, Louis, let's say, in the meantime, there are potential struggles, of course, ahead here. One could be with the UAW, which even as Ford is talking about new profits, UAW is balking at some of the potential contract, I gather, for the next contract period. Explain the issues there, particularly when the union's looking at the companies announcing that it's doing well.
Yes, it is complicated. I think the Ford management would like to have their contracts be on equal footing with those that Chrysler and General Motors have negotiated. So that's, I think, simply what they're asking for the UAW, so they would be fully competitive with these sort of government-owned companies. The UAW, on the other hand, of course, sees that Ford is doing better and would rather not concede further because they've already made many concessions. It's a tough issue, but I think if I were to represent what I think Ford management is thinking, unless they have a competitive cost basis, the long-term survivability of those jobs may be in jeopardy. So the issue is not to injure the UAW, but to preserve the company, its survivability, and the jobs long-term. And that's the dilemma that's always in these negotiations.